David Hare is regularly described as one of the most productive and successful playwrights to emerge in Britain in the post-war era. He was born on the 5th of June 1947, grew up in Bexhill-on-Sea, East Sussex, and was educated at Lancing College. He went on to read English at Cambridge, where he met the playwright Tony Bickett, with whom he founded Portable Theatre, a trailblazing touring outfit that took its work to such unfeat destinations as schools, prisons and army camps in the late 60s and early 70s. His first solo debut, Slag, was produced at the Hampstead Theatre, London, in 1970. In 1975, he co-founded Joint Stock Theatre Company with David Orkin and Max Stafford Clark, and produced with them one of the decade's most seminal ensemble pieces, Fanshan, an evocation of village life in China in the late 40s at the time of revolution, which was described as being without precedent in the history of the British theatre by Michael Billington in The Guardian. In 1978, following poor reviews for his play Plenty, he took his wife and family to the United States, and there, so report has it, experienced a marital and nervous breakdown. He returned 4 years later to London, shortly after which time he was made associate director at the National Theatre, where a considerable body of his work has now been premiered, including 1982's A Map of the World, 1985's Prada, co-written with Howard Brenton, 1988's The Secret Rapture, the Hare trilogy of the early 90s, Skylight and Amy's View in 1995 and 97 respectively, and last year's Stuff Happens, plus several adaptations including Mother Courage and his current running version of Lorca's The House of Bernarda Alba. I'd suggest that during the 1990s, Hare's reputation grew apace so that by the end of the decade, he'd become a central figure in the theatrical culture. Through the achievement of the Hare trilogy, which looked in turn at the Church of England, the criminal justice system and the Labour Party in the run-up to the 92 election, he set himself apart as the most forceful examiner of British institutions in the profession, gaining a degree of access to the heart of the establishment that even privileged sections of the media would struggle to match, and which continues to bear fruit in recent work, such as Via Dolorosa, his one-man assessment of the Arab-Israeli situation, The Permanent Way, his gathering together of testimonies about the breakup and breakdown of the British railway network, and again, Stuff Happens, which charted the international build-up to the Iraq War. If his 1998 knighthood marks an official seal of approval for his contribution to British theatre, it also raises questions about the exact nature of that contribution. Has David Hare succeeded in squaring the circle of being at once left-leaning and anti-establishment while proving his mainstream acceptability? Or has something been lost as the achievements have grown? The backlash against his success finds its most angry articulation in Dominic Drungill's scathing denunciation in The Full Room, an A to Z of contemporary playwriting, which was published in 2000 in the wake of much media excitement over the scenes of nudity involving Nicole Kidman in The Blue Room, his adaptation of Schnitzler's La Ronde for the Donmar in 1998. The most intriguing question about David Hare is how such a flat writer has come to be afforded such a mountainous reputation, he wrote. It still baffles me. I presume the answer can only be a matter of desperate ambition. He simply wanted it badly. Dominic Drungill continued, how did the writer of Fanshan, one of the purest, most original and cleanest works of the post-war period, end up creating the stomach-churning spectacle that was The Blue Room? He concluded, perhaps the early enemy proved too seductive, and what began as a target became a lifestyle. Or maybe the real enemy all along was vanity, and that eventually couldn't be defeated. Without wishing to concentrate too much on Drumgill's assertions, his remarks provide, I think, a useful backdrop for this afternoon's discussion. Before starting, which just let me introduce again the panel properly, beginning with a director acclaimed for his work across theatre, film and television, Sir Richard Eyre, who has played a crucial role in the development of David Hare's career. First as artistic director of the Nottingham Playhouse between 1973 and 78, and then as artistic director of the National Theatre between 1988 and 97. There he directed the Hare trilogy, Skylight, which we're going to be showing after this conversation, and Amy's View. After leaving the National, he went on to direct The Judas Kiss. All three of these plays, dubbed Hare's unofficial trilogy, played on Broadway as well as in London. Next, we have, we have Richard Boone, who is Professor of Performance Studies at the University of Leeds. He is the author of a number of books on modern British political theatre, and most importantly, as far as this event's concerned, he's produced About Hare, the Playwright, in his work, published by Faber as part of a series of surveys of playwrights, for which he's an associate editor. Michael Billington is The Guardian's chief theatre critic. He's the author of a major critical biography of Harold Pinter. And Charles Spencer is, the lead critic of The Daily Telegraph. He's also a novelist, and he'd probably be a millionaire if he'd had a penny for every mention and reworking of the phrase sheer theatrical Viagra, which he coined to describe Nicole Kidman's performance in The Blue Room. Well, we got to the end of the long introduction. I just really want to go around the row first, really, and ask people what their general assessment of David Hare is, if that's possible. I mean, perhaps I could just start with you, Richard. You've written a book about David Hare. If you don't mind me quickly quoting one more thing. In the introduction, you say, as a dramatist, he's perhaps more than any other of his generation succeeded in capturing the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, through the many changes the period has seen. I mean, that's a pretty big statement.
Yes, I guess it is. I think it's a true statement, or I wouldn't have made it. Accounting for it is more difficult, I think. I think there are grave dangers in ascribing mystical qualities to the process of writing, but at the same time, I think there are mysterious processes at work there, and I think one of the things that Hare's done throughout his career is showed a fairly unerring instinct for sometimes almost preempting major or significant shifts in cultural perception. I think that was most clearly seen most recently in The Permanent Way, which was a play which interestingly became, in my view, about more things than its ostensible subject. And I think that kind of instinct is, for me, is what lodges him pretty much near the centre of the theatrical establishment today.
Well, that's okay. Well, that's a good starting point. I mean, I don't know. Just to swing right to the opposite end, Richard Eyre. Do you? It must be strange sometimes hearing critics and academics talking about somebody you've come to know very well and worked with a lot. And I don't know whether it's on a sort of theoretical or a historical level that you appreciate the work of David Hare, or whether you've got such an intimate relationship with him that you've got a rather different overview, in a sense, of the man and his work.
I do have different overview. I'm talking about somebody who. We're talking about somebody who Jonathan Kent described, whose director used to run the Almeida, when David and I were bickering about something or other, said, the two of you, oh, you're just like an old married couple. And I realised that actually is quite a good analogy, because directors are, you know, marriage brokers. They're trying to, you know, effect marriages of text and performance. And it's true, and if it is a marriage, then it's been going for 35 years. So it is very, very difficult to me to be objective about somebody I've been that long involved in, and with his work. I think that Dominic Drumgoole's account, I don't really recognise, and I think it's a caricature. And to pick The Blue Room, which was a piece commissioned by Sam Mendes, as a sort of iconic work of David Hare, is absolute nonsense. If you take Racing Demon, which is my favourite play of his, I think it's a play that in 50 years will stand out as a play which it absolutely recognises, enforces and exemplifies everything that Richard Boone has said about being representing the zeitgeist. It's a play about an institution, it's a play recognisably about a period where socialism has failed and we're left with these essentially great liberal institutions, if you like the National Theatre and the Guardian and the BBC and, if you like, the Church of England, and trying to find a way of moving forward. And this is where David, I think, liberated by a lack of obligation to have an ideological position, a politically ideological position. I think it released in him an extraordinary vein of writing, which also tapped into his childhood, because his childhood, for all that he might appear to the man in the street as a toff, is from a curiously deratinated background in Bexhill and Sea, and he tapped into that in Racing Demon. So I think the answer is yes or no to your question, whatever it was. Oh, incidentally, I thought it was wonderful you said he'd written a play called Prada. He should, of course, write a play called Prada with his wife. But he wrote Pravda with Howard Brenton. And a very, very good example of what you're talking about is Prescience. When I commissioned a play about in 1973 about the Poulsen affair, about civic corruption, it was called Brassneck. And in fact, the Poulsen affair, which is corruption in Newcastle, was sub judice at the time. And the official solicitor came to see it, and also the head of the fraud squad, and said, "How did you get all this stuff? How did you get all this stuff?" And of course, David and Howard had invented it all. And of course, now it appears like social realism, in the same way as who said, you know, the Murdoch press was going to amalgamate it in that way. And Prada, now you look at Prada, it's just, you think this is documentary stuff.
Michael Billington, do you see there being a kind of almost an incremental increase in status, or is that a rather sort of bogus sort of journalistic way of looking at Hare's work?
I mean, no, I don't think it's bogus. I think he's generally got better, and I think the early plays, as I remember them, maybe we'll come on to them, Slag, and particularly one which Richard directed, The Great Exhibition, I think were very callow pieces. And I think Hare's one of the few examples of a dramatist who gets better and better with age, not always the case. And if you want me to place him, I mean, I think he's now one of the four living great British dramatists, along with Harold Pinter, Tom Stoppard, and Alan Akerbaugh. Not necessarily in that order, but I think those four, who, to me, not only individually great, but represent an extraordinary sort of contrast. We can explore that later if you like. You know, they all have different territory, and David Hare's territory seems to me, as both Richards have said, is exploring social and political issues. He has the most extraordinary antennae, it seems to me, for what is going on in the country. I place him very firmly in the state of England dramatists. His obsession, I believe, is with the moral climate of this country, the political climate of this country. And what he's done in play after play is to explore that and to take the temperature of the nation. And just to come back to Dominic Drumgoole's fatuous, absurd comments. To be accused of vanity by Dominic Drumgoole is like being accused of bigotry by Ian Paisley, it seems to me. I mean, his remarks are so ridiculous. It's called David Hare's dialogue flat, I think is the word he uses. It's nonsense. I mean, I've got here a copy of the plays, and I could quote, you know, from examples which are anything but flat. I think the mistake with Hare, though, very briefly, is to assume he's simply a super journalist, you know, that he's simply a journalist dramatist who cottons onto issues. I think, as with all first-rate dramatists, there is a streak of poetry and indeed romance running through all the work. But again, we can come on to that. Yeah. I think he's a major writer.
Charlie, last but not least, in a sense, you were kind of at the brunt of this sort of media furore about the Blue Room, and maybe the whole thing kind of got blown out of proportion. I don't know whether.
Yes, I don't think it didn't really have much to do with the Hare adaptation, though. I think, and as Richard was saying, I think that's very peripheral to David Hare's work. That's great. My feeling about Hare is I agree. I mean, he does absolutely tap into the zeitgeist. It's just whether that is necessarily the mark of a major dramatist to me. I mean, we don't say about Shakespeare that he was wonderful because he tapped into the zeitgeist of the times, because, or that, you know, that King Lear was a play about the need for housing for the elderly, or something like that. And I think that my view is that by and large he is a remarkably good journalist and often a less good playwright. For me, there are two exceptions to that, and Richard's mentioned one of them, Racing Demon, which I think is a play that does lurch into wonderful areas of transcendence and empathy and stands up remarkably well. And also Skylight, much smaller play, is a really fine study of an adulterous relationship and with a wonderful heart to it, I think. But quite often I find a conscientiousness about Hare, that he's trawling through issues. Richard directed the trilogy. That middle piece of that, Murmuring Judges, seems to me to be an entirely conscientious work. You know, it was looking at the police, at the legal system, and at the and the judges. And it just seemed to me to be real, very solid hack work, rather than one of those plays where you feel a writer has. His imagination has been fired and he's soared into places he didn't know he was going to go to. What I find about Hare too often is a kind of pedestrian need to list the issues. He's very conscientious. They're very audience friendly. I mean, I think there is wit in the dialogue, but a lot of these plays I don't think will last. I think they work very well now, but I don't think he's written like the other three plays that are timeless, apart from those two. And the other thing I'd say is I absolutely agree that the top, you know, it's a ridiculous sort of British male's love of lists, but the top four I think are exactly as Michael said. If you think of Akeborn, Pinter and Stoppard, all of them have a tone of voice, a world that is authentic, absolutely their own. What I miss in Hare is that sense, a sense of a writer that create, you know, that you'd only have to read a page of any of those three, or see, you know, 2 minutes on stage, you probably know who it was by. I don't feel that Hare has that, that sort of quality of himself, as it were. That's one of the things I find missing.
Well, that maybe, I mean, I'm sure various people want to maybe pick up on that that assertion or those assertions. But maybe that's a good way of talking about the early Hare work, because in a way, perhaps what's striking is that maybe, and one's reading a lot into the past, particularly from my point of view, that there was this desire to perhaps be more self-abnegating as a writer in those days. When Hare started out, there was a kind of mission almost to get round a table as a group of writers and with a group of actors and create work. And it's possible that some of the questions about identity as a writer that Charlie's picked up on can be threaded back to those early needs to go out on a mission. I mean, that's a big word to use, but I don't know. Perhaps Richard Hare, could you talk about your first encounters with David Hare at that time? I mean, you said in the Guardian interview that you remember as being pretty naturally assured, and he knew his own mind.
He did know his own mind, even when I didn't know him at Cambridge. He's about 3 years younger than me, in many ways, I felt he was much older than me when I first met him, because he had this extraordinary paradoxical presence of, you know, the captain of cricket, very, very good-looking, dashing in a sort of Edwardian fashion, married to this absolutely forthright, scathing, acrid and extremely witty conversation. So he could just eviscerate issues and people, and he was a wonderful anecdotalist. So he was he always seemed to have a sort of charmed life, which has in some way I think been a burden for him, because actually he's incredibly thin-skinned, and it gives this impression of total assurance, which of course is a mask, because he's a welter of anxiety. I just wanted to pick up on something that Charlie was saying about, I think that about his journalism. The Murmuring Judges, I would put in brackets, and I'm responsible. And he was extremely noble about Murmuring Judges, because we'd committed to a trilogy. He was having tremendous difficulty writing it. And if you see, you know, if you take on the judiciary, the police and the prison service, are you surprised? And he said, I really can't get through it. I said, well, David, you're going to have to, even if it means we're going to line up 12 chairs, black chairs, on the Olivier stage, you're going to finish this play. And so I whipped him into that. So you can call that hack work. But actually, I'd say hack work of an extraordinarily sophisticated nature, that a guy can write some of those scenes. I mean, for instance, that first scene of the second act, where Michael Bryant, as an extremely reactionary High Court judge, held the stage with the Home Secretary. And there's this wonderful piece of pantomime, if you like, about the British legal service and in parallel action. There was a prisoner in a cell. It was a wonderful piece of imaginative, and, you know, it's very, very difficult to write plays. And one of the reasons I think David gets criticised is because he's so prolific. And it's wonderful that he is so prolific, and it's very, very rare amongst playwrights, who usually their talent or their energy expires rather early. The need to please, to live and to live to please, becomes very wearing. But just apropos the notion of journalism, I think he's almost obsessively consumed by the subject of what, how do you live a good life? And in that sense, you say it is like King Lear, because that's precisely the subject of King Lear, is the mystery of things. How do you live? I think he's more and more coming to show that, and loss and despair and disappointment, if you like, are his themes.
Michael, just to carry on from that, I mean, do you think that this idea of Hare the journalist, I mean, in some ways he perhaps has recreated an idea of what a playwright can and should do, hasn't he? I mean, there's some snobbery attached perhaps to, you know, a playwright not delivering from some deep core part of themselves, but, you know, somebody goes out and interviews people and brings back material and sifts it and weighs it up and this sort of thing. I mean, do you think that, just to kind of go back to this idea of that stemming from an early interest in the bigger picture, the state of the nation, do you think that willingness to engage with the material of journalism goes back to the very beginning, to Fanchon and this sort of material?
Well, I think it goes back before then. I mean, first of all, as a journalist myself, I refuse to see journalistic as a pejorative word, actually. I think being a journalist dramatist is a fine thing. And I often have quoted, and I will quote yet again, a remark of Shaw's about on this very subject. He said, a doll's house will be forgotten when A Midsummer Night's Dream is still being played, but a doll's house will have done more work in the world, i.e., you know, it would have had a bigger social impact. What is fascinating is how wrong Shaw was, because, of course, Doll's House is still 100 years yet to being played. But you see the point he was making. And I think that's a valid criterion for judging plays, not simply whether they're enduring masterpieces. We're not going to be here in 100 years' time. It's the work they do now. What impact now? The impact stuff happens has now on an audience. Whether it's played when, you know, old times is being played, to me, is neither here nor there. I didn't give a toss about posterity. I care about what plays do for us today. So, yes, there always has been a journalistic element, it seems to me, to Hare's work, because he's obviously, as Richard has said, he's obviously obsessed with the world around him. And I think it goes beyond Fanchon, which actually, in a way, is not journalistic, because what that is, as far as I can tell, is a piece of meticulous research. I mean, the company took William Hinton's book about this Chinese collective and found a way to dramatise it. And that quote of mine which you used, you know, reflected, I suppose, the unlikeliness of that on a British stage. Could I just go back to first encounters, though? Because I have two vivid memories of the young David Hare, one of which absolutely confirms Richard's. I interviewed him about a thing called Lay-By, this collaborative venture he did with, I think, six other writers. And he said, let's meet in the French pub. See, there again, I didn't actually know where the French pub was, so he had to point it out to me. We then met there, and in swept this guy, who looked as if he'd just come off the tennis court, actually, full of a sort of raffish glamour. And I remember with a yellow scarf loosely knotted around his neck, you know, and exactly this sort of, I don't know, out of a Michael Arlen novel or something. And he proceeded then to show this massive self-confidence. I mean, he's about 10 years younger, I guess, than I am. And said, of course, you'll hate Lay-By when you see it. That itself was provoking, to be told I was going to hate it as a critic, you know. And then the second time, my second encounter was less happy. It was the morning after the Great Exhibition, his play had opened at Hampstead Theatre, which Richard directed in 1972, I think. I'd given it a rather, you know, sniffy notice in The Guardian. At 8:10 a.m. that morning, my phone rang, and it was David barking down the telephone at me. And this was my first encounter with the prickly side, which I know exists in David Hare. But, I mean, going back to your basic question, I think the journalistic instinct is there and is very strong, but this does not, it seems to me, in any way diminish him as an artist, because journalism can make great theatre. Via Dolorosa, you may say, is journalism. It's his report on his experiences in Israel and the Palestinian territories, but he turns that experience into something actually strangely moving and oddly poetic in a way. So I don't see journalism and art as necessarily opposed.
Well, some great early encounters. Charlie, did you encounter David Hare in person or in print mainly?
I've had trouble with him. as Richard said, behind the you know, this sort of confident facade, he is incredibly prickly and sort of self-defensive, I think. And but there's no reason why a great artist should also be a thoroughly nice chap. I mean, look at Thomas Hardy. But he is a difficult man, and which brings me to my other sort of nagging worry about him, which has also been mentioned, the sort of head prefect quality of him. And he does seem to me to be sort of slight. There's often in his plays this slight sort of feeling of the sort of I know better than you, the finger wagging, laying down the moral line, and which I find. And while I'm on this sort of knocking bit, I may as well do my last bit, which is it's often said of journalists that when you read a story about something you know very well, it will always strike you as wrong. And one of the most difficult plays I ever had to review by David Harrow is one that sort of rather slipped under the net, which is called My Zinc Bed, about alcoholism. And I had to review this play at the Royal Court 6 weeks before I went into the Priory for treatment of my own alcoholism. And so I was in that stage of really being in trouble with drink, but also in fierce denial about the fact that I was an alcoholic. I knew I was, but of course there was another bit of me that was constantly saying I wasn't. And even in that rather sort of anguished situation, the play worried me. And I've just been rereading it, and it seems to me to be absolute bollocks about alcoholism in general, and AA in particular. If you had to name any organisation which has done nothing but good and has, is entirely benevolent, it must surely be Alcoholics Anonymous. And he has this trite little line that it's a cult, and it's better to, and that you lose something if you give up drink. And it's a hateful play, and I pray that one day it'll be revived and I can really put the boot into it, because I hate it. And that's really me done, really.